We have with us Jacob Appelman from Go Find the Others. He was on a month or so ago and had a nice response. We wanted to have him back and have him back for 2 hours. And just because of that, no one's going to hear you, Jacob. We got to save the good stuff for last. Jim's instructions to all of us is to refresh. I think Lady Viz tried to do that. All right, Lady Viz says it's there, and I'm going to beat you severely later, Lady Viz. If you didn't have the flu, I'd do it right now. All right, so here we are. Folks, you know that the call-in number is 618-912-4681. I'm saying that because you can jump in pretty much anywhere along the line, although give Jacob a chance to get a leg up on at least our first topic. And, Jacob, again, now that it's been a little bit of a rocky start, we've seemed to be okay. I'll cut all this bad crap out. And thank you very much for coming on because you are not at home. It's a pretty exciting day, I think, for the Appelman family. And from where you're calling is never necessarily a guaranteed thing.
Absolutely. It's well, it's my pleasure, and thanks for the invite. I would reschedule or fit it in any way I could. And, yes, we are on the road. The missus is a marathon runner, and she has one bright and early in the morning. So I am in a hotel room far from home and a little bit into Kansas.
And, again, thanks very much. I appreciate it. And, damn, I tell you what, a marathon, even thinking about in the good days, maybe you want to just, like, lay down and take a nap, but that's great that she's able to do that and that you guys are all supportive of that, so good deal. As you said, also, in your salad days, 10 miles was like where you kind of wanted to cut it off, didn't you?
Correct, yeah. I was a ex-rugby player. I was a scrum, tight head prop, played in the front row of the pack there. So we would do 10-mile jogs in clips for conditioning, and that's pretty much my limit. I could do 26.2 if the Trojans were chasing me from marathon to Athens, but I do the marathon radio things, and she does the marathon running things.
I always looked at running as punishment, not really training, but that's okay. All right, now, there's a lot of stuff that's going on, and maybe in the back hour we can talk more about this. I don't want to make more out of it than there is, but I just find it interesting and certainly ironic at the very least, and it's because we don't believe in coincidences. But before we get into that kind of stuff in the second hour especially, what we were thinking about doing is because we come up to that very ominous day, November 22nd, when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And people consternate about not getting down to the bottom of 9/11. Well, if you take a look at it, I mean, we're still spinning somewhere in space about the assassination. At least most of America still is. So what I wanted to do is, Jacob, you know, you said you had an interesting take on this, and we kind of talked a little bit about it off mic. And, yeah, it is interesting, and I think it really is at the base of what we should really be thinking about. So I'm going to throw it over to you. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, with the current passage of the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, you make fascinating and very salient points on your show about the absolute particulars may never be found out. The fact that it wasn't Osama and 19 flying circus hijackers with box cutters, that didn't happen. That's the most important part. We're being lied to is the evident part. The rest may not be able to be figured out. You know, with the planes, the no planes, thermite, bombs, directed energies, mini nukes, you know, there's just so much information, disinformation, and everything in between. That it's really difficult, and like you mentioned, you could get lost in that, arguing those points forever. I don't think that they are insignificant, and if people, you know, are on their own journey or, you know, wish to study all of them, you know, I find no qualm with that. But then when we turn against ourselves, those, you know, who claim to be awake, in being on the same team, i.e., you know, they're lying to us, and then start fighting with each other over how exactly it happened, whether it was holograms or drones or real planes. You know, we get lost in trying to be right. And like you point out, that isn't fruitful. It doesn't progress us forward. And in fact, I see that as part of the plan. you know, with all of my 9/11 studies and work in radio and the internet, you know, there's evidence for explosives. There's evidence for thermite. There's evidence for directed energy. There's evidence that gasoline got some steel hot. So,
right. And what was the other one now? With the I hate the fact that this cat came from Norway, from my ancestors.
Yeah, thermal expansion.
What was it? The water and the aluminum in the planes?
Right.
God Almighty!
Set the sprinklers off, and we had a steam explosion.
Okay, that's right. I'm sorry, but go ahead.
Yeah. So all of the and the more I study this, the more I come to the conclusion, and this is through the help of Sir Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes. I had took it upon myself to read all 1,022 pages of the complete works of Mr. Doyle, Sir Doyle, his quasi-holiness, in the Sherlock Holmes writings. And a point that's made constantly when investigating bizarre, sometimes they're crimes, sometimes they're just situations, that he constantly makes the point that all of the evidence has to be included, no matter what, how improbable, you know, the conclusion leads to. And what I've noticed with the event of 9/11 is that all of these things are there. I've seen fake video, I've seen real video, I've seen things explode, I've seen concrete turn to concrete steam. You know, there's the thermite reaction pouring out of one of the corners of the building. So everybody, instead of trying to pick which one they like and fight over that and discluding all the rest, through my new perspective after reading the Bible of Sherlock Holmes, is that maybe we have to include all of these. And then what does that lead us to? It leads us to the next layer of this operation, which is no matter what camp you fall in, you know, we turn on each other. And that seems to be part of the operation, just like the hijackings, just like the impacts, just like the demolitions, just like the Pentagon are all parts of the operation. So are the multiple trails built into them. So as kind of like part of the escape plan, let's say, they've built these separate verifiable and non-verifiable scenarios into the equation, so the people that are onto the lie then turn against each other, trying to decipher which one of those it is. And in fact, I've switched my perspective to including all of them, because I think they're all relevant and all pertinent, and I don't think it's just one. I think it's multiple, with the intent of, you know, distracting the rest of us who are onto the trail. And so I think our last show, we kind of touched on that, and you've definitely hit that with broadcast sense. And I firmly agree, nobody's ever going to be found right. All of these camps are just that, camps. And the big tent approach kind of seems to be where we need to go. And so with the anniversary, I've combed over the terabytes of information I've downloaded and collected over the years to the JFK assassination, and I see a huge similarity, whether people take the Lee Harvey Oswald theory or the other shooter from the school book depository with the photographic evidence of other windows open. There's the storm drain theory, the grassy knoll theory, the limo driver theory, the Jacqueline Kennedy in the Derringer theory. And when you examine each one of these, it appears, and what I noticed is that they're all kind of equally inconclusive to such a degree that I don't think that could be a coincidence, that, you know, if it was one over the other, it would be conclusive. But a lot of it is iffy, and there's pros and cons to all of them. So I've incorporated that 9/11 approach into the JFK assassination, that, you know, the one answer may not, it's like I mentioned to you, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Just getting you to run around out in the field is the point, not finding the actual grail.
You know, the thing we forget, though, and because most of us are taught that some of the demises of presidents have been lone gunmen or a cult 30 days into one's presidency. But you take a look at, even if you're going to give me the benefit of the doubt, you can go back to William Henry Harrison, and for certain things that he had said about not recognizing the divine right of monarchs to rule, wound up dead 30 days afterwards. And then you take a look at Zachary Taylor. Oh, well, there's an excuse for that. That's the way I look at it. But, I mean, then later on you've got Buchanan, whose inaugural party was assassinated in toto. He didn't die, but I don't know. I think a dozen or more did. And then you got Lincoln, and then you got Garfield, and you got McKinley, and you got a wonder about Harding, and you got an attempt at miss on FDR, supposedly. I mean, and then it goes on and on. I mean, and then later after JFK, you've got the attempt on Reagan. You know, for a country that's supposedly civilized, man, we got a lot of assassinations, and all supposedly that weren't organic, so, you know, like the Harrison's Cold, by lone gunmen. That is an incredible record of success for lone nut gunmen. I mean, they get it pretty much every single time. So we're dealing with something that's been with us for a long time. Most of America doesn't believe that or even know about that. So there is a track record for this happening, and yet still, even in the 1960s, and you can even say in the 1980s, nobody understands really what's on the underbelly of why there are assassinations of our head of state.
Right, and it's, well, and you know, that brings in a whole new set of issues, ramifications, and the whole bit, but yeah, you're exactly right. How are they all gotten to so easily? You know, and like you said, the lone nutter working every time, you know, it's ridiculous, and it should make, the whole thing seem obvious. Just like when I argue 9/11 with people that, you know, aren't even up to speed on any of it, I ask them how anything hit the Pentagon. Anything. I don't care if it was a missile, an airplane, a kite, one of these remote control C4 drones that these FBI informants want to build. How did anything? Isn't that a no-fly zone? Isn't that a fortress of some kind? There's no surface-to-air missiles. The fact that anything hit it should be proof positive. One, they knew and or did it. Or two, they should all be hung the next day, if not, you know, fired and you know, drawn and quartered. I mean, it's just outrageous once you take a step back and look, like you're saying, at the entirety of assassinations. You know, JFK gets a lot of the headlines, but, you know, this has been going on the entire time.
All right. Now, having said that, do you want to tread upon thin ice and start to give us perhaps what you think happened, or if that's important? But I mean, by all means, you know, let's hear it. I mean, I have a pretty entrenched feeling and understanding about what happened that day. I think I'm right. I don't know, but I'm going to throw it to you, because I mean, I don't know where you want to go with this, although that will open up, without a doubt, you know, a whole bunch of avenues, or some people would say cans of worms.
Oh yeah, I've got worm juice all over my shoes already. And you know, I'm not married. Okay, you're pretty familiar with Robert Anton Wilson, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
And his idea of maybe philosophy, that so many people are married to their ideas. And he talks about, instead of using is, you know, if we just use maybe in our philosophical ponderings, you know, how much we could change the energy and atmosphere of certain discussions. Because, you know, none of us were there. None of us know absolutely for sure. We were all doing our best with educated guesses, and some are more educated than others. But, you know, it's difficult because no one really knows. And so this is a maybe pontification I've had, because I've, like I said, went through all of this video footage again. And there were several pieces that kind of dangle around that don't fit very well into a lot of this stuff. You know, get ready for the phone to blow up and the emails. And like I said, this is just a maybe. I'm not married to it. I wasn't there. I was born in 77, so this was, you know, two octaves before I was even...
No excuses.
Before I was born. But there's certain evidence that makes me wonder. And I'll make the statement first, and then we can kind of go over what pieces I've seen that make me think that. I wonder if maybe JFK was one of the conspirators. And that's shocking, and I've said that to other truthers, let's say, and they flip out.
I'm fighting myself right now.
Right. Well, and there's lots to it. The first piece of evidence is really a bunch of pieces. He pissed off the Russians. He pissed off the Cubans. He pissed off the bankers, allegedly, and we'll get into that in just a second. He snubbed one of the Dulles brothers in a handshake live on TV. He makes a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy speech. He's an adulterer. I think it's pretty proven that the voting didn't necessarily turn out in his favor before the wee hours of the morning.
No, it's before the dead people got up and voted.
Right. The Kennedy family themselves, are you familiar with Operation Aphrodite and the older Kennedy, where go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say, I mean, Joe was a son of a bitch.
Right. Operation Aphrodite was an Army Air Corps, I don't think they were Air Force at that time, programmed to devise a way to use airplanes as missiles. They had a couple approaches. They would do just a full-on remote control, tailing the bombing plane, the plane loaded with explosives. They would tail it with a cargo ship and remote control the airplane into targets, chock full of explosives. They also had another way where the pilot and co-pilot, took off normally with the plane full of explosives, and then they would, set the cruise control, bail out, parachute to safety, and watch the plane blow up into its target. And if you fast forward just briefly into, airplanes used as missiles, there's, another connection with 9/11. But the larger context of the Kennedys not being necessarily nice people. I'm not a prohibitionist, but I'm also not for organized crime. So whether or not alcohol was illegal or not, these people still made a massive fortune through gangsterism, through black operations that eventually led in one fashion to 9/11. The election was stolen. There was, like I said, lots of philandering. And then magically, he seems to irritate, annoy, or peeve every power block on the planet. Which, like I said, is possible, but maybe that's part of the design. And another thing I've noticed when researching operations like these, operate world's largest man-made 11. I think that was specifically designed for the maximum effect, let's say. The fact the structures look like an 11, the 9/11. Didn't they break ground on the Pentagon and that place on September 11th? The phone number, emergency phone number, I think, personally, through my research, is part of the operation. A lot of people think it's a coincidence that, they picked 9/11 because of the emergency phone number. I say the emergency phone number of 9 and 11. And if you get into occult numerology, the 9s and 11s are pretty important to the dark magicians. But I think 9/11 was put into place for things like September 11th. The British Israel World Federation published a document in the 63, I believe, that referred to September 11th in a vague, kind of creepy, dark magician way. And then the construction of the buildings in the 70s, specifically designing them to be 11s. So a lot of these operations are put into play way before they're pulled off. The Bush administration isn't the alpha and omega of that thing. This has been in the works for quite a while. And I think the same thing is similar with JFK. Even if you want to take a bare bones Lee Harvey Oswald approach, you know, this man was sent to Russia, you know, and the whole bit to tie him into communism, you know, whether that's completely erroneous or not. But that was definitely, you know, set into play for the fact that he was going to be a patsy and the communist angle could be exploited later on. So if these things are set into motion that far ahead, it's hard to think that, you know, the speech, the snubbing of the Dulles brothers. And here's another one. There's, like, for example, Obama campaigned on, you know, I'm going to close Gitmo, and then I'm going to close Gitmo, and then I'm going to close Gitmo. Then he gets in there, and he doesn't close Gitmo. You know, and we hear a lot of times in Patriot lore that JFK was going to, you know, do things that made the Vietnam War, you know, unattainable for the Hunt oil conglomerations and the Bell helicopter crowd and all these other people that profit off of war.
But one thing, Jacob, I just want to throw in there. I know you know it, but I think it bears saying for folks also. And that is one of the things I think is grossly overlooked is that there could have been a coup that was a little bit more than just countrywide, because the Diem brothers got whacked days before JFK.
Right. And so, and the point I was trying to tie together there, though I've heard the rhetoric he was not for the Vietnam War, I've never seen any conclusive evidence that he did anything to stop it, because we had the Vietnam War all the way up into, was it 71 was the last helicopter flight out?
No, that was 75.
Right, so 12 full years after JFK's assassination. You know, that thing, you know, it wasn't slowed in the slightest. So when I put these pieces together, I'm putting them in a gray bucket and using maybe all the way across. I got to the presidential directive 11101, or I may have the amount of ones and zeros incorrect, but the deal about silver certificates, and everybody says, oh, well, he took a stab at the Federal Reserve, and he was going to start issuing, you know, paper.
Yeah. No, it was going to be silver certificates to replace the Federal Reserve notes.
Right.
Is that right? Okay.
And so I actually went and read Presidential Directive 11101, and it refers to an earlier presidential directive, which gives the power that the president used to have, that the previous presidential directive gave the president the ability to issue silver certificates. 11101 referred back to that and reinstituted that power to the Secretary of the Treasury, who was at that time a Federal Reserve banker and I think has been ever since. So they did issue silver certificates in the amount of a few billion and were quickly recalled. But that's not proof he was taking a jab at the bankers, because if you look and actually read the presidential directives, he gave them more power. And he gave away the presidential authority to issue silver certificates right into the hands of a Federal Reserve chairman.
All right, now let me just hold you there, because I have to agree with you. As much as it seems on face, at least superficially, that he was kicking the can of the Federal Reserve, I kind of don't think he did. And where you're coming from is I agree with, because I just don't think that was the case. And also, what's so strange, too, is, and remember, when you think about the Federal Reserve and the fact that it was created by Wilson, what, in 1913, and then the income tax came in after, well, the income tax came in and around, I don't know how it just went, which was first, but you needed something to feed the beast, and of course the income tax was the thing to do. But you know what's overlooked time and time again, and that is, look at that. Congress took a power that was given to them, and they went ahead and farmed it out to a private bank, and nobody, I mean, that was never brought up in court. I mean, that never made its way through anything.
Right.
If there was anything that was ever unconstitutional, it was the Congress giving what was their responsibility to the Fed. Incredible. So at any rate, I mean, that Kennedy didn't try to poke a stick in the eye of the Fed does not really surprise me. Because really, I mean, who's going to listen? It's not going to happen. Even when you see it today, Jacob, I mean, the president gets up there and says, look, we want to help out people who are underwater in their mortgages. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And the banks are sitting there going like, is that right? Is that right? So So, I mean, so Obama looks good to the people, and the bankers just say, kiss my ass. And here we go, on and on again. So, I mean, I'm sorry to go through that little circuitous side street there, but I just wanted to throw that out, and I happen to agree with you for whatever it means, that I don't think JFK going after the Fed was the big deal.
No, and here's another little piece of that puzzle that I'm intimately familiar with, having lived in Kansas City for 12 years and currently in the Kansas side of Kansas City tonight. The Hunt family is a big player in the shadow elite. H.L. Hunt, Lamar's father. Okay, let me start this way. The Kansas City Chiefs here locally are owned by Lamar Hunt.
Days of the Dallas, Texas. Yep.
Yeah. Well, and funny enough, they moved the Dallas Texans to Kansas City in 1963, maybe to diversify in case things went down. And the Dallas part isn't coincidental. And Lamar is a Silver Spoon guy. His dad was the billionaire. So this technically, you know, Lamar was given the Texans to take to Kansas City. But that wasn't, you know, his team or his money. That was daddy's money.
All right, who was the one that cornered Silver?
There. Here's where we're coming.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's Lamar Hunt's dad, H.L. Hunt, he owned Hunt Oil, which was like the Halliburton of the Vietnam era. They've got all the contracts for the military fuel and refuel and, you know, lots of other things. Daddy Hunt was a polygamist. He had two wives and a live-in girlfriend with which they had 14 children altogether, Lamar being one of those. Now, if you put all of those brothers and sisters together, I forget the name of the one that is the silver magnate, but yes, the Hunt family was intimately involved in cornering the silver market, i.e. Presidential Directive 111101, giving the authority of these. If you think like an accountant and a scumbag, that was a payoff in some way or another to the people who corner the silver markets, which are the Hunts, which also, and I think I mentioned to you this in an email once, in the, you know, how these organized crime groups work, you know, if the Hunt family is an established, you know, multi-generational billionaire family in Dallas, the president isn't getting shot in his backyard without his prior knowledge, let's say. And then you can look at all the no-bid contracts through Hunt Oil on down to the silver market. And this family is fascinating because they also do a lot of underground construction. They dig tunnels for the super colliders. They have underground warehouses here. And in this process, so they get a contract to dig these giant caves for whatever reason. And in doing so, they come across things like silver and other precious metals, you know, the land above these things. And so it's kind of like the railroad tycoons weren't made filthy rich by the railroads. They were made filthy rich by the five-mile window on either side of the tracks they got for all the hotels, restaurants, and whorehouses.
Interesting. Also, that goes back to the Sherman brothers. One was John, who supposedly created the Sherman Antitrust Act that supposedly busted the trust, but all it did was close the door behind Rockefeller and the other ones who had already made it. And, of course, his brother, who was rather renowned for killing Confederates and Indians.
Absolutely. Sherman's March to the Sea. So, and that's a perfect analogy to this Hunt family, that they're working both ends of this thing. You know, there's a movie called, I want to say it's The International, but that might not be right. And in this, the Clive Lewis or the Clive guy, anyway, he works for Interpol, and he's trying to work out this, he's on the case of some international arms deal. And in the investigation of this international arms deal, there's a scene in the movie where, you know, he's questioning this arms dealer about why, you know, why do you guys care about missiles and, you know, is there that much money to be made? And it's kind of like a Howard Beale, Ned Beatty moment. And he tells this Interpol detective quite plainly that the bankers aren't concerned with weapons or war. those things just blow up what people have to take loans out to rebuild. So they finance the weapon side of it, because once the destruction is wrought, now you have to, go to these international loan sharks to rebuild your city, and then that's where the real cheese comes in. Just like Sherman and his brother, you go tear up the South, burn it all down, put the kibosh on any monopolies passed here, and they just, reduce to the number of one who the South could go for to rebuild.
Also, Sherman was whacking the native people because the railroad was going through, and he was the one who knew it and bought land, as you just said, along the easements where the good stuff would go up when the railroad finally got put through.
Absolutely, and not to get my tinfoil hat too shiny, but Sherman lit his first fire on a Tuesday, September 11th, 1865 or 6, I forget which.
Just can't make this stuff up.
It was all accident. It's a coincidence. So I don't think Kennedy did anything to the Federal Reserve. I don't think Kennedy did anything to the Dulles brothers. I don't think Kennedy did anything to the Bay of Pigs. I don't even have a maybe guess on what happened there. So, however they did or didn't piss off the Cubans, I like your take the best about maybe that whole conflagration was to keep the gambling, stateside. Because if people had the choice of, casinos in Cuba or casinos in Las Vegas, the choice, at least for the Eastern Seaboard, is quite obvious.
All right, let me just go over that real quickly for those who are not privy to what you and I were talking about. And also, we had a caller. Yeah, we'll take callers. Is that okay, Jacob? They want to get on this thing?
Absolutely.
You all right with that? Okay, yeah. All right, what Jacob's referring to, and some of you know how I feel about, what I've seen, and that is there is the mainstream thought out there is the mob didn't care about losing Cuba because they had Las Vegas. It was no big deal. I mean, if any of you have any kind of brain, where do you want to be in February? In Las Vegas, or you want to be in Cuba? So there was apparently, this is where I'm going with this, the pressure on JFK to pay back for the election that was definitely thrown his way from the mob in and around Chicago and Clark County. However, you don't touch Cuba. And that goes back to a certain entity in the old world that doesn't want that kind of nation, which is Catholic, to be touched. I mean, we won the Spanish-American War, right? Remember that? We take the Philippines, we take Puerto Rico, and we leave Cuba alone. Is that right? And even through the 1960s, through Kennedy's watch especially, we get into a Brinksman situation with a country that has missiles pointed at us. And even to this day, we never consider them in the axis of evil. We're worried about North Korea,
right,
and China and all this other stuff. So my point was that, and I'd like to get the I-Man to come in on this, because this is something we talked about, not on mic, and I mentioned it to him before. It would seem to be, if you can take this as plausible, that Kennedy had a payback and was willing to do that. He knew about Bay of Pigs. He wanted that to happen, and the CIA abetted him. What I'm also saying is that John Forson Dulles hated him and wanted that situation scuttled. And it was scuttled by the...
It's me with the phone.
I don't know what's happening here. Hold on. Anyway, we got a call. Just hang there for a second. The thing is that John Forson Dulles and the CIA scuttled that thing out from under Kennedy. And as you're well aware, Jacob, that's when 10 days later, in front of an audience of the press at the Waldorf Astoria in New York, he goes into that thing about we are confronted by a monolithic, ruthless conspiracy.
Right.
And so my point was that Kennedy was caught between a hard place and a rock. He couldn't pay off. He also obviously raised the ire of certain entities in Europe. And either way, I believe he was a dead man. Now, thank you, Jacob, for letting me just kind of like give a synopsis of that. We do have a caller, and come on, caller.
Hey, how you doing, Jacob? What's up, Viz? Gene here.
Hey,
Hey, how's it going? I just want to tell you that move, you were speaking, that was the International.
Okay.
With Clive Owen.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think the key point in that movie, with the arms dealers and stuff like that, is that they were saying, here, we're going to, to all these small nations and, upcoming republics, third world countries, we're going to give you the weapons, we're going to lend you the money, and basically it was about controlling the debt. That's what they were alluding to in the movie. You know, when they sit down with that politician who's just about to be elected, and then he's going to make a speech, and then he gets assassinated while making the speech. That's what he was referring to, controlling the debt, which is pretty much what's going on today in this country, right? I mean, you know, they keep talking about the debt. We're never going to control it. We're always going to be controlled.
Right, yeah, and that's what I see, you know, the main component to, not the main, one of the biggest components to war isn't necessarily who wins and who loses. It's all of the loans that need to be made for the things that were destroyed that need to be rebuilt.
Right, exactly. That's part of it, too. I guess you could throw that right under the debt as well, right? You know, we're going to lend you the money, and, you know, we've lent you the money to start war. We're going to lend you the money to rebuild, and you'll be perpetually in our debt forever. You know, I mean, it's same old story, right?
It's been going on for quite a while.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, let me go, because you got a great conversation going on with the Kennedy assassination. That opened up a whole new window. I used to read tons of stuff, you know, about Kennedy. One of the last books I read was a Norman Mailer book about him, about Oswald. And that was so easy to poke holes in. He stressed throughout the book that Oswald was a malcontent, and he had a bad childhood, and he was looking for attention. You know, so why not, after he shoots Kennedy, right, supposedly, just stick his head out the window and say, hey, I did it. You know, if that's all true. But all of these books you're saying that are coming out about the assassination over the years, they're just to obfuscate the truth, right? I mean, that's, you know, they're part of the same team.
Right.
You know, these publishing houses and stuff like that, that are letting these books being published.
Right, and I see that similarly to whether it's the Thermate camp or the directed energy camp or the thermal expansion camp. Those are allowed to be, you know, thrust into the fore so people will pick the one they like the best and then fight with each other over why you're wrong and I'm right.
Oh, that's right. I agree. They get, divide and conquer, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Let me go, guys. I'll catch you guys later. Take care, Vic.
All right, Jacob. No, go ahead. I mean, continue with your thought.
Okay. So the silver thing, the Dulles Brothers thing, the Hunt thing, you know, so let me pick up back with the monolithic and ruthless conspiracy speech. I've heard it a million times, and I read it a million times. And just recently, I went back and read it and here's a perfect analogy. And you led me to this probably without even knowing it. With all the work you've done with all your guests on Huxley, Brave New World, was he warning us or bragging? In a similar fashion, I think it was... and I re-listened to A Brave New World on audiobook just the other week. And I went in and I listened to it once with the mindset of, he's warning us. And then, listen to it. And then I re-listened to it again with the mindset that he was bragging. And you know what? It fits both perfectly, talismanically. It's almost so beautiful if you... consider that he wrote that to make both true. In a similar fashion, the monolithic and ruthless conspiracy speech, though I have no doubts he was referring to one group specifically, the manner and fashion with which that is written, he isn't conclusive to the listener for a direct correlation. So if somebody has a beef with the Jews, that speech fits perfectly. If somebody has a beef with communism, that speech fits perfectly. If you have a beef with the Freemasons, that speech fits perfectly. And it was almost so beautifully crafted to be that vague that it's almost kind of like a weapon to, again, instigate confusion and disorder and divide and conquer, because if his true intention was to warn everybody, then I think he would have came out and said specifically, come hell or high water. Because, hey, well, and the other thing about that speech, that was just a few months after Dwight D. Eisenhower gave his
military-industrial thing.
And yeah, on his way out the door, and that was just a few months into Kennedy's reign. So I want to say they were like 15 months apart or something. So
yeah, but you know, with Eisenhower, that was interesting because he was going to be president no matter what. Both parties wanted him. I mean, you know, he was the kind of hero that was just so heralded after World War II.
5-star general.
Yeah, you know, so he jumps in after Truman, and he does his 8 years. And I remember the adults, not that they were Republican or Democratic voters, but the whole joke, I guess if Johnny Carson was doing his thing back then, the goof on Truman was that he played the piano. The goof on Ike was that he just out golfing all the time. But truly, I don't think he did anything. And I think as a military man, you know, a lot like I want to believe that Colin Powell was and is, when they take a look at really what politics is about, it's a bag of shit they don't want to get involved with. I think Powell just demurred and didn't get involved, but Eisenhower had no choice in a sense. He was the poster for we won, yay, and look at our society now. But at the end, Eisenhower says what he should have said if he really wanted to put a nail in it, and he didn't. He just said it on the way out. He got a little bit of take that and walked away. The thing with Kennedy, I'll just say this. It came 10 days after the Bay of Pigs was thwarted. I find that interesting in its timing, and that he would choose to say that when he did. I see what you're saying, and you know what? I can't tell you you're wrong. Some people have said, well, you could have been talking about banking. And if I look at that speech, I have to say, I can't tell them they're wrong. I got to be honest. I look at it from a different point of view, but I do believe, although you open up a really interesting view of it, and I'm thinking about it and processing and looking at this, I am bitten by the fact, though, that he said it 10 days after he got his ass kicked by his own. And, of course, he and John Forster Dulles, a Knight of Malta, did not get along. There's no two ways about it.
Right.
And Allen also was the real figure behind Eisenhower. In fact, Khrushchev, if you can believe this, said Eisenhower ain't president. It's John Dulles, John Forster Dulles. So.
Right. And you and I think, agree on who Kennedy was speaking about. But the smaller context I'm trying to point out is that he didn't say that. And in not saying that, he only added confusion. He didn't clear anything up for anybody.
You know, to those who he was directing it to, they understood what he was saying.
Right.
If they were relying on the masses to divine that, then they would have. Then you could say, well, yeah, then they wanted payback. But nobody was really picking up on that, I don't think, except God knows for the few. And that's a good point. But, you know, and anyway, you know, I made the thing with the whole bit about Cuba and everything. I just find it very interesting. I wouldn't say that many believe the way I feel about it, but there is one thing I find interesting, and I'll get out of here real quick, because I want to hear what you got to say about Lee, and that is there is a book out there you can read online called The Invisible Government, and there is a section in which it talks about the invasion. Now, get this. The two authors who wrote that book were told, and this was the reason for mainstream consumption. This is what was told to everyone, the reason why the Bay of Pigs failed, and that is because they were dealing with two time zones. Happy Valley was in Nicaragua, from which the planes to give the invaders cover were coming from, and they screwed up the time zones. Now, Jacob, I think you understand, as most people do, that are in the military and are pilots, that the reason that never should happen is because they run on Zulu or Grand Meridian time. And the authors made note of the fact that they thought that rather strange, and by all means it was strange. That was a bullshit excuse that the government gave, which means you know right away there's a problem with the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah, something was up. My best guess would be the casinos, the Catholics, and you're right. Everything else after that is, very hard to decipher, probably intentionally.
Let me ask you this, too. And for anybody who wants to find some more interesting information, this that is portrayed in fiction, have you ever seen the movie Winter Kills?
I haven't, but I've heard you speak about it so much.
Holy mackerel.
I feel like I've seen it.
Yeah, I mean, folks, if you get a chance to see that, take a look at it, because you know they're talking about Kennedy and the old man. And, of course, it's fiction. I can't say that it's, you know, that's fact. But when you take a look at that, certain perspectives on the assassination and even with the invasion of Cuba take on a different light. Now, again, we'll just tell everybody, we have Jacob Appelman with us. He's from GoFindTheOthers.com, formerly InfoWarts. And now we're taking this break too, Jacob. Tell folks about that site, because, I mean, it really is a rather replete site, very orderly, but also very informational. So by all means, and you also get involved with the FM broadcast out of KC?
Correct. Yeah, I got my start 7-8 years ago. I got interviewed on a local talk radio show, 90.1 FM KKFI, Paragon Radio. A friend of a friend introduced us to the host. His name's Ben Johnson. He saw my collection of Bizarro Land. Before Google Video and YouTube took off, I had amassed about 1,000 of these conspiracy documentaries. And so I came in, did a interview about the Federal Reserve. Everybody loved it. I basically never left. Since implementing real-world solutions, I have moved 70 miles outside of the city into the sticks, so I've got at least a head start. Whether it's the New Madrid or, you know, The Walking Dead, you know, I'll have a good head start for deeper push into the woods. But it's reduced my role to a producer and sometimes co-host that I can do, you know, through Skype or what have you from my house. But in the several years of doing the show, I've amassed lots of archives of Paragon Radio. We also got to do a show during the day on drive time called the Radio Redux, which didn't last for very long. Because, you know, you can talk about things truth-related in the overnight hours, but you say that at 5 o'clock and you start getting too many, you know, because this is a 100,000-watt FM station in the heart of KC.
Amazing.
So all those archives are up there. In trying to introduce truth documentary type information to the world, instead of listening to Alex Jones in a bullhorn for 45 minutes and then George Bush talk about the New World Order, for five, I clipped out a bunch of poignant, irrefutable, hard evidence sound bites out of these documentaries. We used to play them individually as tracks and then talk about them. One day I got the notion that it would make a good mashup. You know, and we made them pretty. They're called suicides, like a suicide misty or a suicide fountain drink, a little bit of everything. You know, and so alongside the depravity, we play clips of inspiration, poetry, music, comedy, the whole, anything. If it's, I've often termed it like the Cliff Notes to the Akashic Records or a sports center for the World Wide Web and no sports. So the Paragon Radio archives are up. The Radio Redux archives are up at the site. The suicides that I produce that have been downloaded in every country except for Antarctica and some floating vessels in the middle of the ocean, they're on the site. I have a few articles, a hypothesis I've put forward on, and maybe we can get into this a little bit in the second hour, lots of solution-oriented stuff. And then I started my own podcast after September 11th of last year when I learned some of the directed energy evidence and thought, you know, wow, Police State 4 had just came out. I knew that route had been gone down, and if people hadn't got it yet, then they might not. So my intention then, that's at the time my website was called InfoWarts, WARTS. The original tagline was what one gets, a condition one receives from being mind-fucked their whole life. Gives you InfoWarts. And it was kind of a play on, you know, Alex Jones' InfoWars, obviously, with a little bit of comedy. But then once I figured out, you know, if he's a Vatican assassin, I switched my focus into finding the people that were awake, ready to share information and implement solutions real world. Auditing the Fed may never and probably will never get done, but you can sure cut up your credit cards. And one has an effect in your immediate life and one doesn't. So I started my own podcast called The Next Step Radio Show, as in, you know, now that we understand this information, what's the next step? I implemented real-world solutions into my life once I saw that they did work, like homeschooling my own children, radically changed my diet. I canceled my cable satellite subscription 5 years ago. So I have plenty of time to pontificate, what we can do about this now. So GoFindTheOthers.com is a conglomeration of lots of audio things, from FM radio to my podcast to suicides to stuff about 9/11 and the IRS and lots of fun in between.
All right, listen, let's do this. We are about 2 minutes shy of the top of the hour. We'll break for 5 minutes. Stay with us, Jacob, if you will. We're going to play a little music, and then we'll be back about 3 after the hour and continue with Jacob Appelman from Go Find the Others. Rather uplifting music on this weekend before Thanksgiving. We're with Jacob Appelman from Go Find the Others for hour 2. I was just thinking during the break when I was men all know where they do their best thinking, and that's where I was. I was thinking that Me TV is something that's come out lately, and in the East they show The Untouchables from 12:30 to 1:30. And I'm looking at these shows that I remember as a child, and I'm watching them again, and, you know, Elliot Ness does a knock on the door, just bangs it in, grabs the guy, doesn't even know what he's being grabbed for, whacks him a little bit, pistol whips him, and never reads him his rights because there was no Miranda thing then. And I'm just thinking to myself, as they show that now, if more and more people watch it, they're going to, like, go, you know, it's just like it is today. It just was prophetic. But at any rate, enough of that. Jacob, you with me still?
I'm still here.
Have you seen The Untouchables?
I think I have, but that was probably before my enlightenment, so.
I just have to laugh. Robert Stack. I mean, the body count on that is amazing. And it was funny, well, it's not funny, but in a twist of fate, the Elliot Ness, the real Elliot Ness, who supposedly was such a buster of speakeasies and stuff and gin mills and such, actually succumbed to alcohol later in his life. And talk about an ironic twist, that's one of them. But anyway, all right, we were talking about JFK. Now, you had said something interesting earlier in the first hour about good old Lee. Do you want to run with that?
Yeah, the Lee Harvey Oswald part was so much of this set into motion. His, you know, it's kind of like the hijackers, you know, went to strip clubs and made a scene and left Tehran so they would be noticed. There's so much of Lee Harvey Oswald's travels where he got noticed. As part of the later to be, I guess, motive that they would pin to his Patsyisms. And I find that too odd. You know, for example, this commotion he was making was put into play so far before the assassination that they had to have been working on this. You know what I mean? Since, from that time forward, at the very least, the Kennedy-Lincoln list of similarities that everybody's seen, I'm not too sure that some of those weren't, staged?
Staged, okay.
To bring forth maximum effect, to tie back the assassination to the Civil War, which was the 9/11 before 9/11, let's say. So, with so much of this put into play ahead of time, and here is one of the pieces that really makes me go, you know, WTF! ! There's video of the limousine. And on the back of the limousine are two Secret Service agents holding on to the handlebars, because when the top's down, it's standard operating procedure that there are two bodies between him and bullets. There's human bullet catchers when the top's off the thing.
Right.
Have you ever seen the video
when the guys just get off?
get off, and he's obviously throwing a fit.
Yeah, and let me just say, now hold it right there and go with what you're going to say. I just want you to listen to one thing. He was in Tampa, and then he went to Miami, and then he went to Dallas. I believe that was the itinerary. There was a woman I worked with who was a teenager at the time who was a Tampa resident, and she was on the route that Kennedy took through Tampa. And when we were working together back in the first half of the last decade, she had said that what always struck her was the fact that when Kennedy came by, he just seemed so accessible. You know, and that, and of course, they're not in a bad way. It was just that he was right out there in the open. So this, in a sense, wasn't necessarily a procedure that was only for Dallas. I'm not saying that anybody was called often in Tampa, but it may have not seemed such a big deal to Kennedy. You see, and here's where I'm extrapolating, Jacob.
Right.
It's just that what she had said about him passing by them, she just thought he was really out there in the open. And that's all I can tell you. And then, of course, in Miami, there was a chance where you might have gotten popped there and then eventually in Dallas. But I did see that video, which ostensibly the guy is saying, hey, look, get off it. I don't know why, right? He kind of shrugs his shoulders with the hands open, arms extended to the side, like, okay, you know.
Right, and I've seen, I think, in JFK 2, the Bush Connection, and that documentary was the first place I ever saw that. And it's a pretty fast snippet, you know, and they're, you know, just gloss right on to the next thing. But I went and found way more of that video, and there's a discussion going on about why or whether, you know, the audio is not there, but they're animated. All of this is going on 3 to 5 feet away from two ears of the president. Now, whether he... I just think he was too smart for that not to be some kind of red flag. And again, that's not the linchpin of any of this. It's just another piece in this long list of pieces that don't quite fit any of the explanations. When I made my can of worms statement earlier that JFK was, let's say, in on it to whatever degree... You know, he was. That piece, when that Secret Service agent's ordered off, he's obviously upset and was kind of taken surprise. If my bodyguard is upset at something, I'm going to turn around and ask, you know, what the heck is going on? But it didn't seem to faze him. Like, he knew he was getting down. You know, you think at the bare minimum, he would turn around and say, you know, hey, why are they getting down? And who knows, maybe he was told in his earpiece, you know, there's a good crowd up here and lots of television cameras. We're going to need these guys down for just a second.
Well, I mean, he had a decent run before he got there. Obviously, you saw everybody lining the roads. And, of course, that one comment I think Connolly makes, whether that's realistic or not, about, boy, they love you down here. But then you have the other situation, which you may or may not have been aware of, and that was that motorcade was supposed to go straight through Dealey Plaza and not make a right-hand turn to make a left-hand turn, one at 90. The second one was like 120
right
beneath the book depository. So now what's that all about? You know what I mean? So, I mean, was he aware of the change in the route?
And the crowd visibly goes from mobs on either side of the street to just a few, you know, lingerers. And, you know, so I, you know, it looks like it's not part of the original route. And that leads to my next piece of, in the Zapruder film, right around the headshot, there are directly on the other side of the street from Zapruder, you know, closer to Jackie than you know, JFK, two men with video cameras and a case between them. It's not a glimmer of light. It's not, you know, the shiny hair looking like a gun in the limo driver's hand. These two guys have video cameras filming the headshot 50 yards closer than Zapruder. Neither one of them flinch, and the apparent part to that is a gentleman standing next to them hits the ground like it's a duck and cover drill and he's being paid. You know, so when the shot rings out, this one guy is just on the ground instantly. The other two gentlemen with cameras don't even flinch like they knew it was coming. And where's that video?
Well, but if you think about the Zapruder film, this is another thing. I mean, bullets are flying all around the place, and if you believe that there were shots fired from the grassy knoll behind the fence, which I believe there were, this guy's standing up there filming everything, like, what's the problem here? And I talked to one of, one of the JFK researchers who wanted to stick to the party line, and I said, what's the deal with that? He goes, well, he had vertigo, and his daughter was holding him up. I'm like, what, is she deaf?
No, with a bear hug.
I mean, come on, man. Are you serious? I don't care if he's got vertigo or not. The shot flying all over the place. Why did the daughter just take him to the ground? Oh, no, he stands up there like the Washington Monument shooting this whole thing. Now, you saw what they did with the Zapruder film. You talk about a red herring or leading people down a side street.
That was my very next point.
I'm sorry.
the Jackie Kennedy with a Derringer, the limo driver with a .45, the grassy knoll, the storm drain, all of those are argued within the context of the Zapruder film and back and to the left. And once you analyze the Zapruder film itself, it's trash, up one side and down the other. Wasn't seen by anybody that wasn't on a need-to-know basis for 12 years, I believe, is when it finally was seen by the public. And, you know, the chain of custody, you know, is kind of disgusting. The frames that are missing, you know, there's whole entire documentaries that take the Zapruder film frame by frame and show you where there's obvious pieces missing. You know, there's no other way to explain. For example, when the limo driver, his last name's Greer, right?
It's Greer, yep.
Okay, I went to high school with a kid, his first name was Greer, and I always want to say Greer is the guy's first name, but his last name was Greer. Greer jams on the brakes to the point where those motorcycle cops almost run into the limo. But the way the frames are cut, it looks like a gradual slowing of the car, but he jams on the brakes. I mean, he brought that thing to almost a dead stop. Turns around, you know, some say he shot, the limo driver takes a shot at that point, some say he didn't, you know, and then turns back around and floors it. But the jamming on the brakes, there's obvious frames missing as they leave in a hurry. There's one gentleman in the background, you can see his legs go from, you know, parallel to an upside down Y in like a 13th of a second or something. So there's obviously frames missing there, whether the guy was taking a step or doing jumping jacks. It wasn't a normal human motion to go from, you know, legs upright to, you know, an upside down Y. When the limo comes down that street and they go behind that road sign before the whole thing begins, the frames were clipped before and or after that. So the Zapruder film itself is irrelevant and inadmissible, counselor, is what I say to the people who argue that Greer or the storm drain or, you know, Jackie or the dry. So the whole thing, it seems to me, much like 9/11 with all of the multiple motives and methods of destruction, it's like a giant operation in and of itself. There is no conclusive answer. I think that the thing was built from the get-go to include all of these rabbit trails. And like I said with the maybe statement earlier, I think JFK was aware to some degree of it. There's the Martyr King philosophy where back in the day when, you know, the next king was chosen, it usually went first male son. There were lots of instances in history where there wasn't a first male son. That, you know, the heir was indeterminate. And in some occasions, if the candidates, let's say, would volunteer to do something that furthered the agenda of the royalty, they would be chosen with full knowing that within their reign of terror, they would be taken out in a fashion that would further, like I said, the agenda of the crown. You know, and that was like the tiebreaker.
The one thing also I think that has to be taken into consideration is that RFK gets assassinated as well. And then I'm starting to wonder, is there a common thread here that whomever wished JFK dead wished RFK dead for the same reasons. Now, what are those reasons? And then you can find who the perps were. What I find also interesting is that you have a family like the Kennedys, although they may have been brutal. My Lord, they're not the only ones. I mean, you're kidding. We had the Bronfmans. We got the Carnegies, Mellons and Rockefellers. JFK, I mean, Joe Kennedy was brutal, but just another guy that was playing the game. Everyone else was. And for that family to have gone into such a down spiral to become such tragic characters, you know, you got to wonder what's going on there. One of the things, and I don't want to muddy the waters anymore, I had wondered if when Joe Kennedy was badly debilitated by a stroke, whether or not JFK and RFK thought, hey, you know, we can kind of run with this the way we want to. I don't know. I'm just wondering if that were the case. If so, with the old man out of the way, so to speak, not to corral them, they did a little freelancing, and of course, for presidents, the freelance is never a good idea. And then again, like I said, it leads to both of them being assassinated, JFK and RFK. Who mutually could they have pissed off to become the victims of, certain entities ire?
Right.
What I wanted to ask you, though, too, I mean, getting back to Lee Harvey, now you're absolutely right. Joan Mellon, in her book about Garrison, chronicles Lee Harvey Oswald's travels through Louisiana. I never really understood why Garrison got involved until, I hate to say it, recently, when I read Mellon's book and she came on, and I realized that he was all over the place in Garrison's basic district, and that a lot of what was being done to set up Dallas, which I kind of think always was the location that they wanted that to happen in, that, you know, the Miami thing, maybe. I think they wanted him in Dallas. It was very convicting. Now, but my point is, do you think Oswald was a shooter?
I don't.
I don't either.
Yeah, I think he was patsy up one side and down the other.
And let me just ask you this, Cole, because I got to know. You've seen enough of the video. You know, he could be really good. I mean, if he was a CIA/FBI asset, okay, we know that. He wasn't as dumb as he looked, but not as dangerous as he was obviously later purported to be. But when they tell him that he's been arrested or whatever, indicted for the murder of JFK, when you see his face, honest to God, I mean, I really believe the guy, you know, he's like looking like, oh, shit. You know what I mean? I'm done.
Yeah, that same look reminded me of the O.J. trial verdict reading. You remember his lawyer standing next to him when they said not guilty? And one of his own lawyers looked a little pale-faced, like he couldn't believe.
Get away with that. All right, listen, we got a caller. Let's take him if we can. Caller, come on.
Hey, I didn't mean to call in this way. It's Jeff.
Hey, Jeff, how you doing?
But just happened to be out here in the woods, somewhere out near Andrews Air Force Base in the dark. So,
all right. What are you doing? You filming Blair Witch too?
Yeah. wound up at a very obscure dinner party of sorts. But,
leave it there.
I'll go into that later.
All right. Look, Jacob, if it's all right with you, please. I just want Jeff to play through here because something strange happened this week. Big Jim had said something that happened with Google as well. Angie, who you know very well, Jacob, also got her blog spot taken down. Jeff also got what do you want to call it? I guess an invasion by Google as well. Now, what happened to you, Jeff, and what happened with Angie, then with Jim saying something else took place, what I'm going to ask you is, and Jacob, are you aware of any of this stuff? I mean,
yeah.
Get anything on you, too, or what?
Yeah, we spoke about this the other day. After my last shows with you, I got, because, you know, we brought that up in big picture introductions with, you know, our separate works. But yeah, we went into a good bit of that, and I, put some of those writings up on my site. I got a ton of interference, let's say. Hacked, taken down. I had my they didn't mess with my website. They shut my internet connection off, and Charter was my provider, and they said it was an outside entity, and that's a direct quote, that turned my internet access off after those shows. And you'd sent me the IMAN documents that I could never, ever get up on my website.
All right, now that seems to be central to all this, but let me throw this back. Let's say it's got nothing to do with the mutual element, and that is Jacob with the IMAN stuff, Angie with the IMAN stuff, and you put up a great spread with the IMAN stuff. But what I'm wondering also is, could it be that this might have been a periodical, and for lack of a better word, I'd say in parentheses, I mean quotation marks, was this a sweep that they just went through and kind of gave, a come-to-Jesus message to people?
Go ahead, Jeff.
That's you, Jeff.
Well, the one thing I'm thinking, it comes right on the heels of the failed emergency alert system test that didn't really happen last week or whatever. But
right.
I do find it strange that as soon as I mirrored Angie's content and a little bit of extra stuff on my site, the way that we had discussed to put up the Informer stuff, which I was working on while the show was going back on, when you had I-Man on and James. This comes on right after that, and from the stuff that you had sent me regarding Angie's problem, you know, I'm seeing a couple other people that had the same problem, specifically relating to the Informer content. It was a couple days ago. They first took down my YouTube page, and then instantly after that, they disconnected me from my Gmail account that tied up to it. And for maybe about an hour after that, my website was still up. But then they took that as well, knocked it down. All the stuff was down for about 24 hours. I bitched and complained to them in a very nice way about that, from what I sent you, just saying that, you know,
try.
I asked them politely, my old colleague across the river there in McLean, to please put my website back up, because I know who exactly is doing it.
But honestly, Jeff, I mean, there is something that's common here, what you hear with Jacob, what you hear with Angie, with what happened with you and Angie. I sent her explanation of what she went through and whether or not you can consider their response as truthful or not. And then Jim also says there's stuff that's been taken down on Google with relation to, I guess, some Ventura videos and such.
Mm-hmm.
Would they possibly bring a sweep through? In other words, it's time to go through and kick some ass, get everybody scared, and see if we can chill them out. Well, do you think that this is, and I'd like to think it would be a nice heroic thought, but I don't know necessarily that it's the fact that it's got to do with what we're doing with Informer in Montgomery.
It's either a broader sweep, because I think, man, it is cold out here. Oof, sorry about the chatter.
Is that dog actually chasing you?
No, that dog is here and my friend. Out here in the woods, so who knows who's looking at me through night vision at this point, but I think part of the emergency broadcast system test, what did not happen, part of what they were doing is to see what they could actually shut down and take control of. They said they were going to take down radio, TV, but I think it was just a test to see what they could do, and that was part of it. But because they're so desperate to control all that stuff that they've got something coming down the pike that they're going to have the on-off switch on, and so it's either an overreaching broader version of trying to take control of and do what they can. Or it was specifically targeted towards us, the people who were working around the Informer show and the stuff that was coming back, because out of everything that we're talking about, that seems to be the most damning information that's
coming
out.
I think so.
About who actually controls things. And I just didn't find it. I do find it funny that the people that you've mentioned so far, all those people involved had something to do with the show and his content and who controls everything.
All right, two things. About 2 weeks ago, I heard a soundbite on news radio out of New York that the CIA and I think maybe some other spying organizations, I don't remember, fully admitted, like, this is a big aha, it was, but went ahead and said, yeah, you know, the social networking stuff and the internet, yeah. I mean, we're reading it and we're listening to broadcasts, and I thought that latter part was kind of funny, listening to broadcasts. So that came out 2 weeks ago, and then, like you said, you had emergency network thing that would turn out to be a fart. It was like 30 seconds long. However, still, and I'll say this lastly, I mean, if nothing else, it's a shot across the bow just to let you know, hey, we're here, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, just the story alone that came out of that radio station out of D.C., they, I guess, sort of broke the story about how government contracts, $600,000 to monitor radio broadcasts, see what people thought about. I'm like, really, $600,000? I mean, come on, give me a break. You know, that's like, the bagel cart that they fund with all the intelligence agencies for the amount of stuff they buy, that kind of stuff. They're just letting us know outright, you know, that they're actually doing
it.
So.
Yeah, that's hope of change for them, isn't it?
Yeah.
You find that in the cushions, guys.
Right, oh, yeah, those are the VIP tickets that people are purchasing for, like, the Sandusky Club, that kind of thing, for those fun people.
All right, Jeff, I appreciate your calling. I'm going to let you go. Do I take it that when you're in the woods that this is actually the party you were attending?
Yes. I mean, I will venture back up towards property inside because it is effing cold out here in the woods.
All right. Try not to play any Druids on your way back, huh?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you later, some of the people that are here, you'll find it
we'll go
a little
up top
funny.
Of that. All right, I'm counting on that, brother. Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, Jacob, back to Lee. And it looks like, he definitely was not involved in the shooting. But I have to believe, you know, Judith Vary Baker says that, you know, she was trying to avert the assassination. But look, he's in Dealey Plaza days before it happens. Oh, just like Lee Perbaugh, by the way, happened to be in the salvage place that was just yards away from the Shanksville crater. So we got Lee in the depository. I don't know. You want to paint a scenario? I mean, I can give you one. I think he knows something's going to happen, but he doesn't realize what it is and that he's going to wind up being the principal. How does that fit with you?
I think he probably, you know, a lot of these guys that aren't born and bred into this world that have a quasi-normal start, and then they're let in on, you know, well, what they think is, you know, the upper crust, the black ops stuff. I think they're so enamored with being part of something that, you know, very, very, very few people are recruited for. It's hard telling what they're telling him or, you know, what he thought he was doing there. But I'm sure he saw himself as a James Bond super spy type that had, handing out the communist leaflets in New Orleans. You know, they could have said something as simple as, you know, here's $50,000. We're trying to draw out, you know, so-and-so from the Kremlin or KGB or whatever. What I think he thought he was doing there, it's hard to say, but I think guys like that are just fully enamored with being, you know, thinking of themselves as being in the spy world, that may have been the genesis and or the alpha and omega of his motives, let's say.
Well, remember, I mean, you know, and that's what Jo Mellon wrote about in her book. I mean, it is documented that he was at all these places, and what seemed to make sense was that he thought he was obviously right in believing that this was what he was tasked to do,
right,
not understanding what the totality of it was. Now you have the situation, too, where there were other assets, let's say, that were going to be used if something went wrong with Lee Harvey Oswald. So he doesn't understand he's going to be set up as a patsy, but he does understand he's taking directions. The one thing I had asked Judith Baker was that were there lookalikes that were out more or less being, you know, kind of like rambunctious and remembered, so that people could look back, as they did with the supposed wonderful Muslims who shouldn't be in titty bars and leaving Korans on bar stools, they would be remembered. You know, that's all that needed to be done, to be remembered. And Lee Harvey Oswald was being remembered, and if he had lookalikes out there, they were being remembered too. And there's one thing that also is unsettling, and Mellon had in that book. Do you know about that, I guess, stripper slash prostitute that was picked up by three Latinos on their way to Dallas? They picked her up and they dumped her roadside?
Right.
Are you familiar with that?
Didn't they drive a wood-paneled station wagon loaded down with guns?
I'm not sure about that, but I do remember that she got, and what's ironic is that she winds up in this, what, East Louisiana State Hospital. I think that's got a psych ward or whatever, and Lee Harvey Oswald was trying to get a job in there, I guess, what, a week or two before, but she's in there, and, you know, this is something we forget, but that motorcade was televised right from the beginning, you know, obviously in the area where it was happening.
Right.
Well, you weren't born yet. I was in school, and I don't know, you know, who had full video coverage, but she apparently was in the hospital saying he's going to get shot because she had listened to the three Latinos going, we're going up there because Kennedy's going to get assassinated. That's amazing. And the one cop who heard that when he retired, I think, joined on with Garrison's crew, you know, to try to get the bottom of it, but he was moved by the fact that she was saying, like, she's watching the TV going, he's going to get shot. So
right.
I just find that kind of compelling.
And I think when things like that leak down that far to that echelon of, you know, the conspirators, that's why I say JFK, he had to have known on some level, you know, something was up, because these... Yeah, it's difficult, and he also had Addison's disease, an endocrine disorder, and something that they call like an autoimmune polyendocrine syndrome. So I think it's also the case he was terminal anyway, which plays into my Martyr King idea of you know, him furthering the agenda by playing such a crucial role in an obviously black magic event.
All right, let me get this straight. I think I might have missed something. You think Kennedy offered himself up?
I put that in my maybe category.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. His they diagnosed him with the Addison's disease. He was only like 30. You know, so this was. You know, he had been living with for a long time, and, you know, people are familiar with, you know, his chronic back pain. He had that whole sling thing that he wore that's, you know, in the autopsy photos with blood all over it. I take that back. There's a similar model offered up in place of the original one because that can't be photographed for some reason.
Yeah, somebody had written me last week referring to a movie which... didn't give a synopsis on IMDb, and he didn't realize it, so it was like, okay, this doesn't make sense, the book or not, but it was the idea that something else happened with Kennedy that he was kind of put away. You know, and a lot of things can go out there, but there is one thing I always find that's like kind of like a truism, you know, like one of the, like the basic elements even of physics, and that is dead men don't talk.
Right.
To sit on people, it makes no sense. Like with McVeigh, this plate. You know, to me that's like Oswald going to the theater. You know, and then he gets an injection and all this other stuff, and then you have like two or three hearses that one of them is carrying the body and who's following it, and then his people, whoever's left, his closest survivors in Michigan, don't want the body. And there was speculation that maybe he was up at the Super Witness Protection Program, like on Flat Rock Lake up there in, Montana. But, you know, in those days, you know, Victor and I were talking about it. It's like, does it make sense? You know, people are going to talk. I mean, how long are you going to sit on somebody? And there was hatred for Kennedy, so why wouldn't this be just a gala performance? And man, when you see all the people that were down there, like Bush and Nixon and Hoover, this is like a bigger game than the Cowboys in the Super Bowl.
Right.
I mean, that was an event. And, of course, you may be familiar, you know, with the work by, King Kill 3. King Kill 33. Who am I talking about? Shelby Downard.
Right.
Shelby Downard and Michael Hoffman. I mean, when you look at that stuff, some of it's far out. But if they really wanted to be as occult and satanic as possible, if they needed to do a perfect ritualistic hit, it usually is with three assassins and a head wound. And, man, it happened that day in Dallas, not far from the 33rd latitude.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, kind of how I see this. I don't. And a lot of your work has also pointed me to the fact that this has very likely been, you know, a hoodoo from the get-go back in 1776. And so to think, you know, again, we're talking astronomical odds that, you know, JFK gets in there under the circumstances he did. You know, these guys are still selected. You know, they've refined this election thing down to a science by the 60s. So for sure, he either, you know, like winning the lottery after his dad got sick, decided to play the role of the good guy, or his Addison's disease, his back pain, and his, polyendocrine autoimmune syndrome, you know, led him to do the, if you're looking through the eyes of a black magician, the most ballsy thing ever. And offer yourself up like that.
You know, well, you know, a couple things, too. One, the two brothers received headshots. And the other thing is, and you could say time changes people, and you can't argue with it, but the Kennedy that survived, the PT-109 incident?
Right, the brain cancer, Ted?
No, I mean, when he was out there, when his a PT boat got crushed and they were trying to survive, I mean, that's a story of somebody who isn't going to let himself die.
All right.
And yet that same person, yes, you could say across time, could say, you know, I've had enough of this. Who knows? Except apparently the disease didn't stop him from laying some pipe, if you catch my basic drift. Let me throw this out real quick. The call-in number is 618-912-4681 if you want to get on this free-for-all. But again, and lastly, if you don't mind, we can move on to some other subjects dear to your heart. But when you take a look at the assassinations as it plays into heads of state in the United States, it's a pretty big disgrace, I think.
It is. It's taken in its entirety. MK Ultra, a lot of people are familiar with, the M and the K being mind control. But the Ultra part, this thing is aimed at all of us. A nice side effect are things like no-bid contracts and, you know, crony capitalism. But I think the larger part is the fracturing of the human psyche. So the dark magicians that are doing this use these rituals as a vehicle to reinstitute that fear of abandonment in the average man through things like these well-beloved leaders who are ruthlessly executed in broad daylight in front of people, which can only serve to heighten one's fear and, the deepest fear, the fear of abandonment, the one that can go all the way back to, you know, breastfeeding. That is so primal. They've learned how to pluck that like a guitar string, and it may sound like a bizarre connection, but all of the hope and things that people project onto somebody like JFK, like I said, the money side and the you know, corporate shenanigans are a neat side effect, but ultimately that shatters all of these people's hopes and dreams and wishes, their confidence, their ego, all of the things that were projected into things like the United States, things like the president, things like this dashing man, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. You know, you can annihilate that in the average man seconds after they hear the news of the headshot, because it is fatal, it is primal, it reinstitutes that fear of abandonment, and it's part of the ultra. Like I said, the M is the mind, the K is the control, but ultra. They perfect their techniques on individuals like Lee Harvey Oswald or, you know, these other Manchurian candidates. But what they're doing is finding what triggers these primal fears in people the best, and then once they're figured out, they implement them on the ultra scale with things like JFK and 9/11. It's a pattern that's repeated, and though it seems abstract, they're so similar once viewed that way. It's, you know, one of the few conclusions that I can find that incorporates all of this evidence a la Sherlock Holmes.
Myself at, let's see, what did I do? I just turned 12. And I watch, well, of course, we got the news at 2:30 Eastern time on a Friday that Kennedy had been shot. And I saw most of the females, not all the females, but the female, some females were crying. Because, I mean, I asked for a bathroom pass and just went to the bathroom. And as I was walking down the halls, I'm looking in through the windows of these classes. And I see this, and I'm like, gee, should I be, like, really shook up about this? And I'm not being flip. You know, it's just, I'm so detached from this. I mean, come on, I'm just 12. I don't know what's going on.
Right.
And I see, you know, my classmates crying. I'm like, okay, I guess I got to feel, like, more emotion about this, but it wasn't there. I mean, a sadness and actually a very big confusion was there. So we all go home, and I'll just say this. When I was talking to my parents, I'm like, you know, should we go out and play football down at the schoolyard? Or, like, should we just stay home? And, like what is the protocol on this? And we just kind of basically stayed home. And so I did. And then my father and I get to watch my first murder live.
Right.
You know, and then, but now remember, I go on with this, and then we get Martin Luther King gets popped, and Kennedy gets popped. And then later on, there's like a, you know, close call with Wallace and Laurel, Maryland. And all the time we're going through this, you know, in 76, obviously, I was out of college. That was kind of after the fact. But these other ones, we all, I mean, as kids, you're just like, you just accept what's going on. I mean, even like abusive parents, and you just kind of, you know, okay, what are we going to do tomorrow? But the teachers didn't even touch it. Nobody touched it, and we kind of like just excused it or ignored it away.
Right.
But it stays with you. And now, of course, at my age and others like myself, they're like, what the hell was that we went through? How do we ever consider that normal? And like you said, it's got to do, you know, with that trauma of having the tip pulled away from you. And with that in mind, let me ask you this. This is a country that has a largesse in many, many sectors. That's being taken away from us. I think we're going to plunge into a situation where we're going to look for something to help us out. And like, you know, a child with an abusive parent, yeah, you get whacked by it, but it also will nurture you. And even going back to the infant that's looking for the tit, I mean, can you see? Well, let me just ask you this. I don't want to lead you down that road. Are we getting prepared to be in that situation where we are absolutely fawning and dependent upon mommy state?
120,000%. They're... You know, all of these stories in the economic world all come down to the same primal fear, the fear of insecurity, whether it's your next drink of breast milk or your next house payment. This is being threatened to be taken away. We're going to take this away. We're going to take this away. We're going to take this away. And if it doesn't ravel your nerves to the point of insanity, you will be lots more easily pliable. Way more subservient. Yeah, it's a building up and taking away, building up and taking away, threat, 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 and then to the point where they're either going to gain compliance before a big crash, or, you know, they'll crash it to, try and gain ultimate compliance. But to answer the question, yes, I the same primal fears of abandonment and lack and, no more booby juice. That's what I see all of the economic situation news reporting events have in common.
And the other thing that comes with this is, think about this. Now, think about what you're doing with your wife to try to indemnify yourself as much as possible from the shitstorm that's coming. But what's also interesting is while everybody's losing their head, some astute individuals will turn around and wondering why you aren't.
Right. and that's a perfect segue into kind of how I wanted to tie all this up today. And it by no means is 2 hours an adequate enough time, but I see so much value in knowledge and experience. And for example, to use a sports analogy, to consider somebody a Hall of Fame baseball player, that is something that can only be assessed by the observer. Very few people, Pete Rose, can walk around and just say, I deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. I deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. Though you may or may not deserve it, proclaiming it will never make it so. The people who have observed your play will make it so. In the same regards, I see things, and I'll just use Christianity because it's closer and most familiar to people, but this could apply to Islam or Judaism or Hinduism. The people proclaiming themselves to be Christian the loudest generally aren't, or they are Pete Rose-ish. They're kind of Christian, but a whole lot of other. So to conduct yourself with Christos, to learn from the teachings of the Messiah Yeshua, is a totally different thing than calling yourself a Christian. And what I've garnered from the massive teachings, not only the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Gnostic Gospels, the Apocrypha, and the the Dead Sea Scrolls, I've taken all this in. And there are such profound teachings in there that, until incorporated and lived by, are worthless, though they're inspirational. So I would never call myself a Christian. That would be something others could assess to me at the end of my career. But one of the teachings that's replete throughout all of these texts is usury. And it's so obvious to me that was a key point in the whole story, and it slips past. We hear a lot about the Ten Commandments. We hear a lot about the death and resurrection. We hear a lot about the sins and the salvation. But very few people that I know call themselves Christian talk about the usury aspect. Now, the bankers are scumbags. How they're dealt with on this earthly plane, any way that shook out, I wouldn't be bothered. But it's insignificant until one stops being usurious themselves. So, like you mentioned a million times, that you got out of the mutual fund game, because that is our version of usury. The banksters benefit on the other end, but the common folk benefit from usury as well. Credit cards, mortgages, car loans, student loans are all forms of usury. These people cannot play quadrillion-dollar derivative games of craps if those who wish to act Christos or walk in the path of the Messiah, if you don't give them usury sticks to beat you with, they can't beat you with them. I firmly concur with all of these sentiments about the global economic catastrophe, but it will never be dealt with properly until people understand their role in it And I have a bizarre saying that I tell people that I've made it to the bottom of many of these rabbit holes, and what I found are mirrors. Because once you get through all these layers and levels and dolls within dolls and pyramids within pyramids, it's a picture of you looking back at you. Are you a soldier carrying out illegal orders? Are you paying for illegal wars? Are you, each of us individually have some form of contribution to this insanity. And while the insanity needs to stop, our part of that has to be one of those next steps. So we volunteered our house back, the one we had a mortgage on. And if people aren't familiar with Latin, the first half of mortgage means debt.
Isn't that a great thing?
We turned in our brand new Honda minivan and bought two cars we could afford in cash. We cut up all of our credit cards. I cashed out everything 401k related that I could. I still have one thing out there that allegedly kind of like Social Security, I have no say in, even though it's technically my money, but whatever, it's not being contributed to anymore. So while everybody fears this economic crash, that's the only thing that's going to save us. And to bring that about for yourself will be required if people are concerned with things like the Messiah, Yeshua, or, Old Testament or New Testament scripture. They're very clear about, usury. The global economic debt is the culmination of all of our individual credit cards and death gauges and car loans. These banksters wouldn't be able to gamble $1 trillion collateralized debt obligation if we weren't participant in said usury. The solutions aren't simple or going to come about quickly, but the usurious economy has collapsed in my life a long time ago, and it was hard, and people laugh at you. The another part in the scriptures that talk about how the masses will view you when you walk the righteous path. But claiming to be righteous and actually walking the path are two separate things. And instead of fearing this crash, I've often said, let's make it happen.
All right. Now, well said. And for folks, I think we've said this a bit on the show about the fact that, look, we know banking is there, and the bankers down the block necessarily aren't bad guys, but when you take a look at the scope of the industry from time immemorial, you will realize that Jesus had, the most vituperous words towards two classes of people or two industries. One was banking and the other was lawyers. So usury has been institutionalized. We call it interest. We all understand it. You know the adjurations in Scripture about do not be a borrower or a lender. We all been caught in that to a certain degree, but if we are, then this is probably a good time to try to square accounts and get out of it, and that's what my wife and I did too. Right now we're in a very good place, Jacob, as you are. You go through a little hit as you do it, but when it's done and it's okay. The hit that the government takes, it's like, oh, good, this is my farewell card to you.
Right.
And then we went into gold and silver and such, but there is something coming down the road, and the best you can identify yourself against it, that's what's smart. I mean, the NWO is a crushing thing. I mean, whether you look at it secularly or in a spiritual manner, it's going to come. You forget all this patriot crap and proclaiming victories that never are won. What Jacob's talking about is smart talk, and the thing is that you still have your family unit, and there is going to be a hard landing for everybody, but you can soften it to a certain degree, at least if you have some wisdom, common sense, you can get through it. I'm not going to belabor it anymore, but again, as he was saying, I mean, we're not talking that all bankers are devils, although the banking industry would never be there if we all lived under divine law and didn't get into the situation we're on now, which, of course, Christ saved us from through his death and resurrection. But it's there, but still in all, it's enticing, but you have to start to break away from it. And, I mean, I'm to a point now, and I don't know if I can do this, Jacob, but, if we could relocate, which we want to do, and I know this is crazy, it may not be a big deal, but I mean, I always want to get into a situation where I can, like, just get rid of my driver's license and all the other crap, you know?
Absolutely. And for folks that it seems so overwhelming, that's why I named my podcast The Next Step. Do one thing at a time. You can't get off the grid tomorrow, but you can cut up your credit card tomorrow. You know, you can't, one step at a time, pick the little ones and you're going to notice how much better you feel, how much relief you feel when everybody's abuzz about the, you know, micro 1,000-point drops in the stock market. I giggle because it doesn't affect me in any way, shape, or form. Other than the fact if it goes full tilt boogie, you know, I'm going to have to guard my garden a little better, but you know what I mean. Those stressors, those fear-based mind control tactics they use don't have that effect because you're not subservient to the creditor or the lender or this fictitious debt anymore. So all the mortgages could go belly up, all the credit cards could go belly up, everything in the stock market could crash, and financially my life wouldn't be any different tomorrow, you know, other than the fact of dealing with people that weren't prepared. But, you know, a positive attitude and some ammunition can help you in those regards. And I also heavily advocate people learn how to use longbows because
okay.
You know what a three-burst round from an AK sounds like, and have you ever heard an arrow coming?
Right, exactly. But your point is that no matter whether you're living in the urban situation or you can get yourself out to a rural situation, it would not be a bad idea to reduce your profile before financial institutions and the government as best you can.
Yep. The pyramid of control, you know, the capstone is where the power is at, but it's held up by all those blocks underneath it. And instead of standing there and waiting for this thing to fall apart on top of you, you can get out from underneath it, and you know you'll feel some tremors, but no blocks will land on your head.
And I think above all, at least folks should kind of. I mean, I do it regularly. Let me just say I do that. I can do what I can, but there's a point at which I can't make another step. But the thing is that I just think through. What if, okay, and give myself some avenues to follow if this happens before I wanted to. I mean, you have to run it at least through some scenarios so that you knew what you would like to do or can do when the doo-doo hits the oscillator. I'm not so sure it's going to happen all that soon, but still in all, the thing is, why not just run through it now? And that in itself is an insurance policy and a relief to a certain extent of one's anxiety, because at least you've got an idea about what you want to do. But to go ahead and just say, well, whatever will happen will happen. Well, believe me, it will happen. And you're going to probably wind up, you know, on your knee pads more so than you'd like to think.
Right. And that's where my focus of finding the others is crucial to my path, is because I'm not a biodiesel fuel engineer. I have found somebody within horse riding distance from me that is. Because I am not a craftsman woodworker, I have found somebody within a horse riding distance that is. And then you communicate and participate and help people unselfishly. You know, giving is the best way to get things. So when the oscillator does hit the fan, you have people around you that, because nobody is self-sufficient yet, there are within 6 degrees of separation, as the saying goes, you know, ways to be self-sufficient with as little, you know, if you live in a high rise in Manhattan, yeah, I don't know what to tell you. there's things like the meek shall inherit the earth that come to mind when I think of that, you know, and each man chooses his own path. You know, some people want to die in a fireball, but for those who want to survive and continue the human race forward, whether it's just a few of us or a whole lot of us, there are people around you that can help, and you don't have to feel like you need to be an expert at everything or it's not even worth doing.
No, and you know, I was thinking also that one of the less dramatic fallouts of where we're going is a world that is, I mean, or a country, first of all, to start with, and it's going to be global, that is run strictly by the state. And, I mean, can you imagine going to the store and being treated like you're going to the DMV?
Exactly.
I mean, you're going to be filled with a world of bean counters, little people who just want to bust your balls. It's like going to the airlines. And that's all part of the deal. I mean, if you're in an urban situation, it's going to be a little bit more prickly, but a lot of people can't, you know, extricate themselves from that. But there's still things you can do to be a little bit more self-contained and to keep yourself going while all others are losing their heads.
Right, and one step at a time, you know, you'll feel better. Get rid of the credit card, get rid of the cable TV. You know, if your kids are little, homeschool, eat better, you know, just drink, you know, clean filtered water, you know, incorporate things one step at a time, you know, and before you know it, as time's flying, you can look back and wow, all of a sudden you have freed yourself from so many of these snares that you're walking a little bit lighter and things are making you a little more happy. And, you know, all of a sudden you're surrounded by the others, you know, people who care, and you can have a conversation that it doesn't involve sports or, you know, American Idols or whatever.
Oh, man. Okay.
And by sports, I mean steroid outrageous.
Okay.
Listen, I'm in town for a marathon. You know, I play the rollerblade sports, and, you know, there's plenty of exercise and fun to be had, but...
I tell you what, in the end, as it was in the beginning, in between, I had the scholarship and a shot at pro ball. But I love what was said in, what was it, Chariots of Fire, was it? With the two runners, one was a Christian, one was a Jew. Do I have that right?
Yeah, and it's right on the tip of my tongue, too.
But I love what he said was, and this is really what athletics was supposed to be about, was just to keep yourself in good shape, because he said, I feel God's pleasure when I run.
Right.
That does it, man. That's all it was about. And when I got older, when I played, I think of what Gretzky said. He goes, in the end, you don't play against another team. You play against your age. And I tell you what, it was good. It was just fun to be out there. Can't remember the wins and losses. Can't remember the trophies won and not won. Doesn't matter. It was just fun to be out there. And exercise is good. And that's all that was. It just turned into a very rabid and you know, malignant form that we call now the National Football League and et cetera. So.
Yep.
But anyway... Jacob, I know you did want to address something that was positive and that was solutions-oriented, and I don't think you were reaching for it when you said it just now. That is absolutely the truth, and soon it's going to be put into practice. So we're going to get out of here, but before we do that, Jim, before you kick in the outro, Jacob, you got last call on you know, anything we did today, and also one last plug you know, about your website and the broadcast that you do.
All right, gofindtheothers.com, gofindtheothers.com. There's my friend Ben Johnson's two radio shows that I've co-hosted and co-produced, the Radio Redux and Paragon Radio. All of that's broadcast on 90.1 FM KKFI, 100,000-watt blowtorch in the heart of KC. The Suicides audio documentaries I make, and then my podcast, The Next Step Radio Show, plus a bunch of neat stuff. In writings and pontifications, it's where all of my online stuff and radio stuff can be found. As we move into the JFK anniversary, the assassination, the ritual anniversary, before we do like we've always done and argue with those who think differently, maybe a new approach and combining efforts should be looked at. You know, and think of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. You're running around through the field. There might not be a grail at the end of your escapade. And that in itself can be a relief, because what these people are trying to do is destroy us mentally. That's why the mint part is in government. This is a mental thing. Physical domination is very hard to do. Mental domination seems to be a bit easier. And we don't have to play. So whether it's 9/11 or JFK, politics in general, remember the power has always rested with the individual. What they're doing is usurping our power, and we don't have to let them. It's going to get ugly, but, you know, that's where I think faith comes in, because I think what comes out of the other end of this thing will be the most faithful.
All right, Jacob, thank you very much. And yes, I mean, that I agree with you absolutely. It's the time for preparation, but not for desperation. So thanks a lot for coming on. I'm sure you're going to be back again. I'd like you to do that. You guys have a safe holiday, and best to your wife tomorrow when she goes out there and runs, for some strange reason, what, 26 miles?
26.2 miles.
All right. But, who's counting? All right. Thank you very much, Jacob, and we'll see you down the road.
Yeah, thanks for the invite, and have a holiday yourself.
I will meet you on the other side of the blue. At the bottom of the sea.